We've been following the surge of undocumented immigrants, especially minors, at the U.S.-Mexico border in recent weeks. It's been a controversial matter. In Arizona, protesters on both sides of the issue are demonstrating. Immigration remains hotly debated across the country. A new documentary, however, takes a different approach, following four undocumented students who enter an underwater robotics competition in 2004. The group was from Phoenix's Carl Hayden High School, which is predominantly working class and Hispanic. They were the underdogs, going up against illustrious MIT and other elite schools. Jeb Bush Jr., yes, of that famous Bush family, is one of the executive producers of the film, and he joins us to talk more about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's go through the arc of this a little bit. Give us some of the context here. What happens in the movie?
So essentially, these kids show up at the competition, really just bootstrapping their underwater robot, you know, really going there because their teacher convinced them to give it a shot. They had nothing to lose and, you know, sound like a fun field trip. But they show up there, and this is the most prestigious, one of the most prestigious robotics competitions in the country. They have judges. They have essentially three different tasks that they ask the robots to do underwater. So the kids essentially pass successfully two out of the three tasks and end up winning the competition.
We're talking about four kids here, very talented, going to high school in America. Some of them are born in Mexico, having kind of a hard time. And let's play a couple of clips from the film. In this clip, the team from the high school, Carl Hayden, is landing at the competition at UC Santa Barbara, and it's just another world.
When we walked in, we were different.
Yeah, we definitely felt out of place. Our accent was definitely something that stood out there.
And I had never seen that much white people. Nobody was Mexican or Hispanic or Latino.
And not only that, Jeb Bush Jr., their robot was a little, well, I'm going to let them describe this kind of really Rube Goldberg-esque robot.
We looked like the carnival had arrived. Just a raggedy-ass robot. Looked like we just pieced together everything from a junkyard.
So give us a little of the background of this, would you? We've got this high school in a challenged area and this robot that they basically built from Home Depot.
You know, not only these kids use very limited resources, but if you take a step back and realize that they're literally in the middle of the desert in Phoenix, Arizona, that are entering a underwater robotics competition. Not a lot of places to practice out there. So they enter this competition and go out to California and compete against the best colleges in the country, schools like MIT, and come out victorious. It's really an incredible story.
One of these kids had been in a gang. The parents had mostly blue-collar jobs. They're all interviewed in Spanish, not in English. And what happens is that when they get to that competition in Santa Barbara, the robot takes on water, threatening its electrical components. And this is one of my favorite parts in the film. They're driving along, and they figure out that they can use a tampon to fix it.
The boys went at it, brainstorming ways to deal with the water in the mechanical housing. Ideas that were just downright embarrassing.
We started talking about desiccant, which is what the stuff in diapers is, which absorbs all the liquid.
Lorenzo said, well, wait, aren't tampons the same material?
And so everyone started getting quiet because, one, you were going to start asking, how do you know this? And the second thing was, who's going to get this?
And that line just made me laugh out loud. I mean, talk about literally thinking outside the box.
Very creative. There's a scene with the MIT kids speak about that. And they were surprised as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, it got the job done. And it was a very simple approach to a tough problem.
You are no stranger to the political world. And your father is the former governor of Florida. Your uncle and grandfather, both former presidents. What did you want to say about the issue in the form of a documentary?
I do a lot of work on the immigration reform side, but also something that we saw as it relates to education reform, films like Waiting for Superman, really brought down the issue almost to a bite-sized level and kind of the reality of it, and trying to get this film in front of policymakers and opinion leaders around the country as they talk about this issue.
I understand that you're bicultural yourself.
I am. My mother is Mexican and dad's a gringo, as we say.
What goes through your head when you see the stories now? You couldn't have known that we had the kind of border crisis that we are experiencing this summer when you were making it. when you see those pictures about students, young people trying to get over the border?
Well, it's an extremely difficult situation. At the end of the day, we gotta step back and realize these are kids that are trying to seek a better life. And so as a great country, we should really focus on being great and being humane and taking care of these kids. I think most of the frustration you see now in the media has to do with a lack of efficiency or lack of functional government, which has caused a lot of frustrations amongst conservatives and liberals.
One of the young men we see here, Oscar, has a particularly poignant story. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Oscar is an incredible kid, and he essentially came here as a young, essentially as a baby, grew up in this country, got a scholarship for engineering, and essentially wanted to become an American citizen, but couldn't go through the process. And when he was at college, he was enlisted in ROTC. He wanted to serve in the military. And so what he did is he essentially deported himself and tried to come through properly. And long story short, Senator Durbin really took it to the floor in the Senate, promoted talking about how this kid wants to serve in the military, help our economy, be a good citizen, but couldn't get the paperwork done. So it's a good example of the kind of situation we're in now as it relates to the way the immigration system's not working.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new documentary, Underwater Dreams, that explores immigration and educational policy through the lives of undocumented students in Arizona. My guest is Jeb Bush Jr., and he was an executive producer of the documentary. Being the son of such a famous Republican, former Governor Jeb Bush, I know that he says he doesn't want to run for president, but a lot of people hope he would, and others say he couldn't win the nomination because of his stance on immigration. Are you hoping that one of the outcomes of this is that it nudges the Republican Party on immigration?
Well, this is what we've been trying to do through the film and other means to really communicate to folks, to conservatives, to opinion leaders, to look at this opportunity that we have to grow our country. I think, in my perspective, this is a conservative view. We should need to focus on immigration reform for our economic needs and doing things like securing the border and Dreamer legislation. So hopefully this is one of many things to get the conservative party, but also leadership in Washington to act.
You mentioned Senator Dick Durbin's hearings on immigration a few years back. Have you shown this film to any Republicans? Because I didn't see a Republican in the movie.
Throughout the last couple of months, we've been essentially doing screenings in a few cities, but we're trying to get politicians, elected officials, to the film. So the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Center for American Progress are hosting these screenings for us, and we're inviting elected officials to come see it. So yes, there's been a lot of conservatives or Republicans that have seen it. We've had a very positive positive reviews thus far, so we're excited about it.
And you just mentioned two groups with the Center for American Progress and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that we might think of as not always working together. So I know that you're not in politics yourself, but what are you recommending needs to be done to improve the lives of undocumented students and their access to education here?
Sure. Well, essentially having a platform for educating folks. I mean, I think we could all agree that it would be better to educate more people with a high-quality education at a lower cost than the opposite. And right now we're doing the opposite. We're making education more expensive and harder to get. So as it relates to immigration and kids that come here young, I mean, we should create a platform. For example, in Florida, they passed funding for undocumented kids that they get in-state tuition. I think that's a good thing. So hopefully other states follow suit.
But we have been hearing so much about immigration reform basically being stalled permanently now with Congress as it is and the White House being at an impasse with Congress. Are you at all hopeful?
I am. Just a question of when. It's tough to imagine any significant piece of legislation happening before the midterms or perhaps under this administration, unfortunately. But, again, through the film, we're hoping that we start projecting a positive message and opportunity that folks could really get behind to see some type of immigration reform as soon as possible.
Speaking of politics, many of the students from the robotics team were attending university in Arizona when Proposition 300 passed in 2006, and that barred undocumented students from receiving in-state tuition. I was really wondering how that affected the people in your movie.
Yeah, it was a huge issue. I believe it was Proposition 300 in Arizona where they got rid of in-state tuition for undocumented kids. So when you're in college and, you know, we obviously have student loan issues in this country, but if you could imagine paying a few thousand dollars for your degree annually and then that goes up 4 or 5x, it's unsustainable and it makes it very difficult to stay in college. And so some of the kids that were taking advantage of in-state tuition had to drop out and had to get a job.
Anyone from this movie?
Yeah, two of the kids couldn't get their degree and ended up going getting a full-time job. Which it's great to work, but education is very important.
So where are these four young men now? You mentioned that two are working.
Correct. So two are working. One is a janitorial supervisor. Another of the students, Lorenzo, who's got a great sense of humor you'll see in the film. He's working as he has his own catering business. And then Oscar, who we spoke about before, became an American citizen and has served in the military in Afghanistan. And now works for as an engineer in a railroad company.
But the other three are still in that indeterminate immigration status, still dreamers.
Correct.
Jeb Bush Jr. is executive producer of Underwater Dreams, a documentary set to premiere on MSNBC and Telemundo next week. It's currently out in select theaters, and he was kind enough to join us from member station WLRN in Miami. Good luck, Jeb Bush Jr.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to literary news out of Africa. In a moment, we'll pay tribute to South African writer, activist, and Nobel laureate Nadine Gordimer, who passed away on Sunday. But before that, we want to hear about a new generation of writers from the continent. Now in its 15th year and often nicknamed Africa's Booker Prize, the Kane Prize for African Writing is awarded annually to writers for a short story published in English. Previous nominees and winners include the celebrated Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Noviolet Bulawayo, and Binyavanga Wanaina. Last night, the prize of £10,000, that's about $17,000, was given to a young Kenyan writer, Okwiri Oduor, for her short story, My Father's Head. The judges described it as an uplifting story about mourning, Joycean in its reach. She exercises an extraordinary amount of control, and yet the story is subtle, the judges said, tender and moving. It's a story you want to return to the minute you finish it. And we're lucky enough to have Okwiri Oduor joining us now to talk more about it. And also with us is last year's winner of the Kane Prize, Tope Falarin. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
And we want to say a huge congratulations to you, Okwiri. You just got compared to none other than James Joyce. So how are you feeling about everything that's happened today?
I'm still stunned, to be honest. It hasn't really sunk in. I think it'll take a few days before that. I am surviving on about 2 hours of sleep, so maybe later I'll be able to process it. Maybe. How was it for you, Tope?
It was exactly like that. I mean, I don't think I slept at all the night before. And so I remember being in a complete daze the morning of, and you're probably more eloquent than I was.
Let's tell the world a little bit more about your story, Okwiri. This is called My Father's Head. I absolutely loved it. And it deals with the narrator's struggle with the loss of her father and her attempt to reconstruct him, to remember him. And this whole context, what was it for you? Was there a family member that you had lost? I understand that you did go through, at some point in your life, sort of a period of remove or estrangement from your family.
Yeah, I had just left home. I realized I was transitioning from childhood to adulthood. One day I woke up and I was an adult and I didn't know what happened. And I was trying to make sense of it. I did not know what happened to my childhood. I think I was grieving it. I was trying to understand it. Also, the fact that I just moved away from home and coming to terms with adult things like mortality and, you know, realizing that your parents will not always be there. Mm. And you won't either, so...
Tepei Falaran, you won last year's prize for your short story, Miracle. And I also thought that was incredible. And that's a scene in which a young person is in the presence of an evangelist. We won't go through it all right now.
Sure,
but
sure.
It's a remarkable story. And I know that you've read the 5 short stories that were shortlisted for the Kane Prize this year. Tell us a little bit about what stood out for you.
Well, I liked Okwiri's story a lot because I was really intrigued by the theme of exile in her story. I think she's kind of referenced that a little bit in what she just said. But for me, the most deeply affecting part of the story was that kind of second-person bit that happens towards the end of the story when it's apparent that somebody, I'm assuming it's the main character, has come back from some time away and is trying to reconnect, but at the same time recognizes that reconnection may not be possible. And also the idea that perhaps she's trying to exile her father from death as well. And so there's this really poignant and deep kind of connection between the narrator and the narrator's father because of that that kind of trying to return from exile. Am I on the right path with that at all? Or
Yeah, I think so. But everyone has a different interpretation, and it just amazes me.
Well, that's a mark of a great story, right? I mean, I think if people are assigning any number of interpretations to your work, it means that you've deeply impacted them.
I would entirely agree with that. Also, there is such a wonderful vibrancy in these stories. And, you know, I know that you live and work in D.C. now, Tepei.
Yes.
There's been some questioning. What is it you think that resonates for American readers so much with these stories?
I think in the case of my story, it was based in America, and there's a kind of yearning for a desire to be placed here, a desire to be here and be somewhere else at the same time, and maybe a desire to kind of choose one or the other. And I think, again, with Okwiri's story, there's a sense that many of us, even if we've spent our entire lives in the States, we sometimes feel exiled from where we come from or where we would like to be, in a way. It doesn't have to be like, you know, I'm from across the globe. It could very well be I'm from another state, I'm a member of another family, or even the sense that you're meant to be doing something you're not doing. That itself can kind of feel like you're exiled from something. And so I think in the literature that we're writing, that feeling of trying to connect to something and that sense that you're lost is incredibly accessible because we're all writing from that place. We're all trying to write in a way back home. And I think that's what's so profound about Okwiri's story. She's trying to write back home, I think, in a very important way. And the character certainly is trying to get back home to her father's love, trying to get back home to knowing who her father is, and trying to get back home to herself as well.
Okwiri, you are a short story writer, but I understand you're working on a novel as well. What is the novel going to look at?
You know, when people ask me what the novel is about and I tell them it's about loss and grieving and coming to terms with these things, and they tell me, yeah, you're writing the short story again. But I think there's many ways of grieving, like grief for lost childhood or grief for dislocation, not knowing where home is, exile and things like that. There's so many different things you're grieving for, and my novel deals with that.
Have you named it yet?
Break some news.
No, I can't share because it probably will change.
I know the feeling.
It changes so much.
Yep. I wanted to ask a very quick question. Binyavanga on Twitter said yesterday that you've been on the verge of this breakthrough for the past 2 or 3 years. You've been knocking on the door.
Oh, really?
It was really interesting and I thought warm comment. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about your journey and what he means by that kind of knocking on the door.
I had no idea Binyavanga was watching me, reading me.
It's a generous comment.
Yeah, it's
what
a great comment.
It's very generous. I've been writing for a few years. Most of the time it felt as though it was the wrong thing. It's the right thing. I feel it's the right thing to do, but people around me thought it was the wrong thing, always encouraging me to snap out of this phase and get a real job or go back to law school, go to the Kenya School of Law and get your postgraduate diploma and be sworn to the bench and begin your practice as a lawyer. So for me, it just feels like coming full circle. Mm. That for once people look at me and they tell me this is the right thing. It's, you know, it's not illegitimate.
Where did you find the resolve to continue in those moments when people were saying, you know, go back to law school or do something else?
I just felt like I didn't have a choice, really. Nothing else felt right. I was only happy and fulfilled when I was writing, and I think I also wrote to escape and somehow also to reconstruct memories of times gone by when I didn't have to make decisions like this. I think I was just procrastinating from my life, and somehow it became my life, so I'm grateful for that.
Before we say goodbye, the awards ceremony last night included a minute of silence for the South African writer and Nobel laureate, Nadine Gordimer. She passed away, of course, over the weekend, was one of the patrons of the Kane Prize. How did she influence you? Do you have anything you'd like to say about her passing?
I just find her deeply inspiring as a woman and as a writer. She had ideals and she stood up to them. She was an anti-apartheid crusader. She's very vocal, and that inspires me to just keep doing it. You know, my voice is necessary. My voice as a woman, as a writer, as a young person, she encourages me to push on.
Well, thank you so much. Okwiri Odor is the winner of the 2014 Kane Prize for African Writing, and she was kind enough to join us the day after winning that award from the BBC studio in London. Tope Falaran won the prize in 2013. Tope, thank you so much for coming in. It was great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congrats again to you, Okwiri. It's just wonderful. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we wanted to continue our discussion of Nadine Gordimer, one of the most influential South African writers. Ms. Gordimer passed away Sunday at 90 years old. She was the winner of the Nobel Prize in 1991, and she grew up in a small South African mining town, the daughter of two Jewish immigrants. She's best known for her fictional novels centered on themes of injustice during the South African apartheid regime. Joining us to tell us more about Nadine Gordimer is Neelika Jayawardena. She's senior editor and writer at the Africa is a Country blog and also associate professor of postcolonial literature at State University of New York, Oswego. She's with us today from Cape Town, South Africa. Welcome to the program, Neelika.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
Let's review Ms. Gordimer's dozens of works. We'll just go through three of them at the moment because I'd like to focus on the three that were banned in South Africa. One, A World of Strangers, which she published in 1958. That was followed by The Late Bourgeois World. And then Burger's Daughter. That was the most recent one, 1979. Would you take us back to the context in which these novels were published, Neelika, and tell us their effect and why they were banned?
You know, I think in many ways I can reduce the reason why she was banned to saying she wrote about what was unspeakable in South Africa. In the 50s, the struggle was becoming an armed struggle, and our leaders were being sent to prison. And she was the first person to kind of address some of those things that people were not allowed to speak about anymore. And in fact, a fourth book was also banned, July's People, was also banned under apartheid. And in fact, it faced censorship under the post-apartheid government as well. A provincial education department temporarily removed July's People from the school reading list, describing it as deeply racist, superior, and patronizing. So, I mean, I think that Gordimer ran afoul in a way of both governments, but definitely under apartheid, she was a person, a spokesperson for freedom, and she definitely riled the system.
Let's hear her voice a little bit, Neelika. I'd like to play a clip. This is from an interview that Nadine Gordimer did with Fresh Air's Terry Gross in 1989. Let's listen. Here she is.
I think that a writer must always maintain the independence, the artistic independence, to use his or her insights, something that a writer has beyond the insights of other people, without worrying whether you're going to offend your mother, your best friend, or whether your political confreres are going to decide that you have let down the side. A writer must never let herself become a propagandist.
So she told it as she saw it, a clear-sighted writer. But I think that she herself has said often that she would not perhaps have written about apartheid or become the writer she did if she hadn't lived in South Africa when apartheid was going on during her lifetime, began and ended during her lifetime.
Right, and she did pay a price for it. It wasn't that her life was easy because she was a white person. In fact, late bourgeois world was banned for 10 years. A World of Strangers was banned for 12 years. And she said that after that length of time, most books are pretty well dead. And it's only, you know, after the end of apartheid that people paid attention again to her old books. And so she paid an artistic price, but she always lived, you know, under the threat of more than censorship. And I think that she had a political impact on the country, and people who were imprisoned in Robben Island, political prisoners, read her. And today on Africa as a Country, we have somebody who wrote about that, that alongside the writings of Karl Marx, Rosa Luxemburg, Samora Michelle, Fidel Castro, and Chinua Achebe, and countless other revolutionaries and authors and thinkers, Nadine Gordimer's work occupied a pride of place, he said, in the study and reading menu of Robben Island. So I know that it wasn't that she only wrote for white people in South Africa or for a foreign audience. People far and wide, including me, of you know, three generations removed in a small rural town in Zambia, read her, and my imagination caught sight of something that felt familiar and explained something that I didn't have words to explain.
Do you think that you credit her with becoming a writer yourself?
I think she was one among many. I think, you know, she was really the first African writer that many of us in my generation read. And although I don't teach her, because I want to teach a generation, younger generation, about the black writers, I know that my students are able to return to her through, after reading Ndebele, after reading Ishtiaq Shukri, the young writers of South Africa, for instance. And they may not read Nadine Gordimer first, as I did, but they are able to return to her.
How did different groups respond to her, black South Africans, Afrikaners, and others who come from Sri Lanka, or as your family originally did,
yeah,
in the minute we have left?
You know what? People far and wide have sent me messages on Facebook and on Africa as a Country saying she was the first African writer they read. Everybody from people in Mexico City to Bombay read her, and they saw the world of the African colonial struggle, struggle against colonialism and apartheid through Nadine Gordimer first, before they read anything else. So I really credit her for being the ambassador.
And a favorite book?
A favorite book. Honestly, it was her first book collection of short stories that she first published as a young woman. It's not the ones that are popular. If you read those, they speak to a world of a young woman who's just beginning to question her world. I love that book.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Nilika Jayawardena is the senior editor and writer at the Africa as a Country blog and associate professor of postcolonial literature at State University of New York, Oswego. Nilika, thanks ever so much. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
It was a pleasure, too. Thank you.
They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Each week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, we're turning the tables to talk about caring for an elderly parent or a loved one. If you've been there, as I have, you know it can be exhausting, complicated to manage family relationships, finances, and of course, the needs and wants of your loved one. And all of that is even more complicated if you have to seek legal guardianship or custody of your relative. So we wanted to hear more about all this and get some advice. With us now are Howie Crooks. He's an attorney who specializes in elder law and practices in New York and Florida. He's also past president of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and he's joining us from a member station, Colorado Public Radio in Denver. Hello there.
Hello.
Hi, Howie. Thanks for being with us. And Marilyn G. Wax is NPR Senior Business Editor. She became a guardian for an elderly relative. She's in the studio with me. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi, Jackie.
And Fernando Espuelas, one of the regular parenting contributors here. He hosts a radio show on Univision America Network and help care for his grandmother. Hello there, Fernando.
Hi, Jackie.
So welcome, everybody, to the program. And Howie, we're going to begin with you. Many of us see elderly relatives lose a step, become a little forgetful. Of course, this doesn't happen overnight. So what are some of the decisive moments or signs in which you might want to think about pursuing legal guardianship, a more extreme, perhaps, move or concern?
Certainly. Guardianship all across the country is supposed to be a last resort remedy. So just because somebody is slower in their decision-making or becoming a little bit more forgetful, that in and of itself would not necessarily translate into the need for guardianship. The court will always look to alternative arrangements that can be put into place prior to the appointment of a legal guardian. And the reason for that is that when guardianship is pursued and the court appoints a legal guardian, in all states, it's going to result in either a restriction on civil rights or, in some cases, the complete removal of civil rights. And that is an action that the court does not take lightly and will want to make sure that this particular individual is in need of those rights being removed and the appointment of another individual to make decisions on their behalf.
So what does it take to obtain legal guardianship?
It involves a court proceeding. Papers are filed with the court seeking the appointment of a guardian and laying out the foundation for the reasons why a guardian is needed. In some cases, there are people who have an issue with wandering and cannot safely get back to their home base. In other cases, there are people who are unable to pay their bills on a regular basis, and their decision-making can be flawed. And those are usually justifications for the appointment of a guardian because they're not able to handle the things that you or I might take for granted.
Marilyn, you had to get guardianship of an elderly aunt. How did that come about?
Well, I had been close with her over the years. She was a widow and had no one else really to depend on. And as she started getting older, I could see that she was maybe going to need help. She was by herself. But the great thing about our relationship was that it was trusting enough and open enough that she set up an appointment with an attorney, and we went through everything while she still had her marbles. You know, we didn't wait until it was too late. I had a living will and power of attorney, and most of all, I had this relationship with the attorney in Florida. I live in Maryland. She lived there. She liked her life in Florida. She didn't want to be in snow. She didn't want to move north. So she wanted to stay in place, but I had to have some steps to know that I could protect her as things moved forward. Well, after it, she pretty quickly started going downhill after we signed all the papers. And my goodness, I can't even imagine the costs if we hadn't had that front loaded, because the attorney, everybody knew that I was her go-to gal, that everything was clear. I had even brought in a cousin with me when we went to the attorney's office to make sure that there were witnesses in the family, that I didn't twist her arm, that we all knew we were on the same page. So what I wanted to urge today to people, just thinking about money and your life, is this is a big time of year for family reunions. When you get together, when you're sitting at the picnic table with your family members, try to get this conversation started. You need to front-run these problems and not wait until it's a crisis, because, believe me, even with everything in place, it was a nightmare in a lot of ways. You know, you have to sell her house. Well, you also have to empty out the house, and you have to divide up whatever there is there. And, I mean, it's just one step after another. And if you don't have that situation where you have somebody you trust at a family reunion, a friend's reunion, whatever, but have the conversation before you have a crisis. And that'll save you a lot of money, because attorneys are not cheap. I mean, the more you can front run this and get yourselves organized in a peaceful setting, not in a contentious, setting or in a hallway of a hospital, but to think it through clearly and lovingly, so that you can really get ahead of the problem before you have to feel yourself just, I mean, the stress levels involved in some of this are just off the charts.
Well, and you mentioned trust a number of times and clear lines of organization. We'll talk before we conclude about what happens when there is perhaps not that trust amongst mm-hmm. family members. But first, Fernando, let's get you in here, because I understand as a teenager, you helped care for your grandmother when she was sick with terminal cancer. That's mm-hmm. quite a responsibility for a 15-year-old. Tell us about your role.
Well, we were immigrants at that point, early immigrants into the country, and I was the only family member who spoke English. My grandmother was dying, and my mother was freaked out about it, or didn't really want to face that reality. And so I often played the role, well, all the time, played the role of being in front of the doctor telling me things, and then deciding for the care of my grandmother and changing the story for both my mother and my grandmother. This is not one of the best traditions from Hispanic culture, but mm-hmm. I knew that was expected, and so I just had to swallow it and deal with it.
So that must have been an extraordinary circumstance for you. What were some of the lessons that you took away from that for other members of the family's elder years, and maybe even thinking ahead, you're a youthful person, but to your own?
Well, I certainly wouldn't wish that experience on anyone. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, even up to today. But in retrospect, I realize it created in me a tremendous amount of strength, being able to deal with this situation and having to deal with it. I didn't have a choice in it, which in turn gives you courage. I mean, once you face that, certainly as a kid, you can face almost anything.
Yeah, well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the challenges of caring for an elderly parent or loved one. My guests are journalist Fernando Espuelas, NPR business editor Marilyn Giwax, and elder law attorney Howie Crooks. And Howie, I'll come back to you. You're joining us from Colorado. You know, my sister happens to be an elder care attorney in Colorado. What are some of the complications you see? Because I have certainly had her share, without naming any names, a lot of complications. Sisters and brothers not agreeing over where mom should live. Somebody disappears because someone gets custody. I mean, the stories really could fill novels, some of them.
No doubt about it, Jackie. And I just want to make a point before I respond to that question, which is a lot of this can be avoided if advance directives are put in place. Marilyn mentioned that for her own situation. Advance directives like powers of attorney, healthcare proxies, and living wills are documents, legal documents, that are designed to allow an individual to appoint others to make decisions for them in the event that they should become incapacitated themselves. With these documents in place, in most cases, guardianship can be avoided altogether.
Would be preferable.
Which would clearly be preferable. It's less time-consuming. It's less intrusive because all of your financial records are open up to the guardianship court. The guardian still needs permission to do certain things, which means you have to go back to court to get a court order. Things will flow a lot more smoothly if you have these advance directives in place. And even where you have multiple children, you can designate one or more than one to make decisions collectively. But the point is that this is a self-directed kind of thing. You do have the power to direct how decisions are going to be made for you if and when you should become incapacitated. And where there's a potential for conflict, my view is that you have the inherent responsibility as a parent to take this action so that you can give direction to your family members and say, if I become incapacitated, I've already thought this through, and this is who I want to make decisions for me. And I've had lengthy discussions with that person so that they have a better understanding of what my wishes are and can better carry them out and thus avoid guardianship. But the conflicted situation that you raised, when you're in a guardianship scenario, it is not a happy place to be in a courtroom with siblings fighting over who should be appointed the guardian. In many cases, when a judge sees that the children are fighting, the judge will decide that neither of the children should be appointed as guardian because there's too much infighting going on and too much animosity, so they'll appoint an independent person. Well, after living for 80 or 90 years You're going to have an independent person, a total stranger, come in and start making decisions for you. Yes, it works in some cases, and that's why it's there and it can be done. But that's not the ultimate place that I think everybody aspires to be.
Okay,
better to talk about it in advance.
Thank you, Howie. We've just got a couple of minutes. What other pieces of advice would you have, any of you, Marilyn, in this kind of, I mean, I'm trying to imagine raising it at the picnic table. That would be ideal, but boy, I pass the cake. There's something I want to talk about. That could also be hard.
I think it's you do almost have to walk yourself into this because it's hard to talk about our own mortality. Nobody likes to think about their mom dying. You don't want to think about your own death. It's very hard. So I really recommend that people, if you can, go online. If you don't have your own access to being online, go to the library. Or there are all kinds of senior groups. AARP has a lot of advice. But if you just start reading about it, thinking about it, there are websites that'll tell you about how to set up a will, what's the difference between a do not resuscitate and a living will. They are different. There are all sorts of things where you can start to prepare your mind almost to accept that this is a serious matter. And then, you know, from there, maybe join with a church group, a AARP type group or whatever to talk yourselves into it. There's even a website that will send you a monthly reminder to tell you to, don't forget, get your will together. Those kinds of things where, start online, start easy, start with a book, and then work your way up
to
a group.
Thanks, Marilyn. A couple of words for now.
Yeah, very quickly. My in-laws managed their whole process years ago. My wife has three sisters. They created a whole structure, even down to who was going to get the mirror, and it worked really quite well when that moment came.
Well, thank you for sharing that so much with us. Fernando Espuelas is radio host at Univision American Network and a regular contributor here. Howie Crooks is an elder law attorney, and he joined us from Colorado Public Radio in Denver. He's also president of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys there, and our own Marilyn G. Wax. Thank you all very, very much for being here.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally today, it's time for the feature we call In Your Ear. Throughout our years on the air, we've been asking our guests to share the music that inspires them. In our final weeks on air, we thought it'd be nice to hear about the songs members of our staff are listening to. Today, editor Amitha Parashar-Kelly tells us what's on her playlist.
I'm Amitha Parashar-Kelly, and I'm an editor here at Tell Me More. The first song playing in my ear is Paul Simon's Obvious Child.
Well, I'm accustomed to a smooth ride. Oh, maybe I'm a dog who's lost his pride. I don't expect to be treated like a fool no more. I don't expect to sleep through the night. Some people say a lie, it's a lie, it's a lie. But I say why? Why deny the obvious child?
Now, I love this song because a couple years ago I was on a long road trip and my wife put this song on in the car and I was like, where has this been all my life? I just love the drum beats. I love how it starts kind of slow and it builds faster and it adds in different instruments and his singing.
Had a lot of fun, had a lot of money. We had a little son we thought we'd call him Sonny.
And I just think it's a really happy song, and I wake up to it. It's my alarm in the morning, and I listen to it at work, and it's just very upbeat. And another song playing in my ear is Basement Pangra Anthem by DJ Reka. Is a New York-based Indian-American DJ, and she started having these parties. I moved to New York after I graduated from college, and she would have these parties that were like $5, and you could go and dance all night, and she would play all this great Bhangra, Indian, Bollywood music. And she is also known for collaborating with a lot of different artists. So this particular anthem that she came out with, Wyclef Jean is on it, and it just has a lot of interesting rhythms and melodies and parts to it. song that's playing in my ear is Higher and Higher by Jackie Wilson.
Your love lifted me higher than I've ever been lifted before. So keep it up, quench my desire, and I'll be at your side forevermore.
I got married last year, and it was the Recessional, which is the song that we walked out down the aisle to, and it's just really happy and fun, and I love all the voices in it. A great song to kind of remind myself to keep my head up no matter what's kind of changing in life, to kind of stay positive and be uplifted.
That was Tell Me More editor Amitha Parashar Kelly telling us what's playing in her ear.